interesting things about interdisciplinarity is that we are bringing to this relatively fairly straightforward, in some sense, topic of the of interfacing knowledge, an immense number of perspectives and an immense number of ways of problematizing what this means. And while that's potentially very productive, it does mean that it's a daunting task to actually begin to relate these very different things that have been discussed over the last couple of days. And I have an interesting perspective on this because I come to this as a member of the Microcosms group, and we've said Microcosms several times, but our subtitle is Objects of Knowledge, and we're firmly rooted in the materiality. And my own background and practice as an archaeologist in a museum setting is particularly relevant to the rest of the comments I'm going to make and the things that struck me over the last 2 days and that I flagged as they went on to bring back. So I wanted to take a couple of moments to actually say a little bit about the way that that I come to this, or the metaphor that strikes me as certainly constructing my point of view on this, and that is from the museum. And from some very particular museums, because one of the first things you learn in a museum is no two museums are the same, except insofar as they have the problem of managing the physical relations of things. And so spatiality is something that we can't forget, those of us who come from museums. The shelving units and the way that that those are actually arranged are have great implications for what you can do to produce knowledge in the archive of the museum. Those shelves that are inaccessible are accessed less. It's simply a fact. So those things that are on those shelves become less important to discourse. But we also have catalogs, and catalogs in museums have a long history of various kinds of attempts to systematize and create different systems of reference, much like the original Library of Alexandria that we heard about, in which the catalogs themselves and the indices and the organizational schema take on a life of their own and actually produce much of the systematization of knowledge that then reflects back on the things on the shelves. And so you have enormous projects to create kinds of catalogs that then are instantiated in reshelving or rehousing projects in which the objects are physically rearranged in order to conform to a system of knowledge that was created first in the index. So that's the context I come to this kind of thought from. The idea that we are actually always dealing with a movement back and forth between a physical organization of pointers of some kind to ideas and indexes and categorizations. And Jeff Bowker, I think, has given us a very good sense of how those forms have a history and an ongoing shaping, that sometimes they can outlive their original life and require new metaphors, the three architectural pillars of the tree of life, beginning to actually strain at what a tree is, that it needs pillars. Given my perspective, it's probably not going to be any sort of surprise that I would say that the thing that we have discussed for the last 2 days is the materiality of metaphors, and metaphors to materialize certain kinds of relationships. And I think that's the tension that we really do want to keep in our grasp, that the splice, I want to begin with the splice, because it seems to me the splice is in some sense the perfect metaphor for what we want to talk about. And I'm probably not going to mention the word interface again in this talk, and perhaps I will be able to actually sustain that in the long term, because it seems to me the splice is actually a better figure for us than the interface. The splice being the point of a metaphor by which we come to actually embody knowledge. It's the point of separation, but also of connection. And that that kind of a metaphor that we body forth, and that then also gives rise to the way we are embodied, is precisely why it matters to have this kind of a conference that on one level might be thought to be incredibly academic. You know, at the most really unrelated to the kinds of world events that are going on outside here, and to which there have been references, but which are, for the most part, not touched by the kind of discussion we have today, you might think, on one level. But on another level, we need to have this kind of a discussion because it's through these kinds of metaphorizations of the way that we exist as people in a world connected to other people that allow things like the events that we're currently engaged in on a global level, every one of us implicated as a citizen of the, well, not the evil empire, I guess. So, with that as a beginning, and warning you that I think what we're talking about is the materialities of metaphor and the metaphorization of materiality, some of the knowledge that I've gained the past 2 days, I want to begin, actually, with something that Sue Ellen Case said this morning when she began, saying that she thinks that perhaps we can talk about the interface as theater, a performance space with instruments. And that was followed very closely by Margaret Moore saying that the interface makes the machine and the body influence each other. Now, putting these two together, we immediately have the splice as a place, as a particular kind of space in which the body and the machine influence each other. And it's that influence back and forth that leads us to actually the idea that what we're doing is not necessarily a process of translation, which is a term that came up several times, but a process of what I would call the construction of an interlanguage, a concept from anthropological linguistics, and specifically being employed very productively in looking at those situations in the early history of European colonial expansion into the Americas, in which European and American subjects speaking different languages mutually constituted a new language, which rather than seeing this as a classical issue of translation in which the Yucatec Maya translated their culture into Spanish or vice versa, my colleague Bill Hanks, the Maya specialist in Maya languages from the 16th century, is looking at it as the process of construction of a new language which is continuous with the previous Yucatec Maya language in its structure, its semantics, its grammar, but is newly meaningful because of its confrontation with a new set of meanings brought to bear by the Spanish. And this concept of interlanguage, I think, is what several speakers were groping towards when they were using the word translation and feeling uncomfortable with it. What we're needing now is to think of ourselves as being in the process of constructing an interlanguage. So, if we're engaging not in a process of translation, but of the construction of an interlanguage, then a second point that I think has come up several times and was most clearly put by J. David Bolter is that one of the capacities or one of the characteristics of this interlanguage, the splice now as interlanguage, is that it has to be reflective. And here I want to unpack the idea that the reflection, as opposed to the window, brings to bear the issue of embodiment and representation simultaneously. Where our splice is a window, a transparent thing that we see through and we can imagine ourselves passing through and thereby ignore the body, the reflection, the mirror, instead gives us back an image which is part of our embodiment and which is simultaneously a representation. And so a second kind of aspect that I think, again, many speakers have been echoing versions of this in their own language, and I'm claiming the right to translate into my own language, is the idea that representation matters and that representation and embodiment are somehow being co-implicated here. And I take the figure of the mirror of reflection as a useful way to think about this. And the fact that artists are literally making the digital machines body forth mirroring as representation is, I think, a clue to us all in the way that art can, in fact, imagine forward and in advance of other kinds of thought and can then set the road for us. I want to also take up an interesting statement that that Larry Carver made in our very recently concluded discussion. The human is the bottleneck. It was in response to a question, so it may be a little unfair, but I think it's very interesting to think about. Because one of the things that I think goes back to Wolfgang's saying we want to actually interrogate this personification is that this mutual movement back and forth in which we're engaged as we splice ourselves together to our machines is that we become aware of ourselves as objects just as we become aware of the objects around us as personae. And here, as an anthropologist working in non-Western settings, the personification of objects doesn't bother me at all. It is always already. But what bothers me is the fact that in the Western European tradition of the 20th century, we've taken that as a one-way move. Once we open it up and see it as a two-way move, I think it becomes much less problematic in that what we're actually saying, following Bruno Latour, is we've never been modern. We are now in a world in which all the humans and non-humans are acting together. So the human as the bottleneck becomes a very interesting question or image, and I'm taken by the fact that a bottleneck is a part of an object that's made of glass, just as a window is made of glass and a mirror is made of glass. I begin to wonder, as a material culture person, why glassy metaphors are what attract us. And I see a possibility that it's inherent in the materiality of the computer itself, but I also see a possibility that there's something about the way we think with glass that we might want to take relatively seriously. And that's not meant as a throwaway comment. I take very seriously the idea that, as the archaeologist and metallurgist Heather Lechtman has said, that there is such a thing as technological style, and that different societies have technological styles that result in their creating their material world in different ways. Again, something I think we in Western Europe have tended to minimize until perhaps very recently in our re-encounter with machines that actually present us with at least the illusion of agency and therefore begin to make us think more seriously about the fact that all the other objects around us that have agency. When we begin our individual lives, we are shaped more by the objects around us than we shape the objects around us. So, we're the bottleneck. Well, what are we the bottleneck on? That's the other thing that I immediately think of. And what we're the bottleneck on is the circulation of something. And I'm going to call it the circulating reference, again, in a nod to Bruno Latour. And I'm going to connect this to something Alan Mew said, that that knowledge isn't being activated unless it's in circulation. And that leads to the idea that we're actually engaged in circuits of transmission. And in fact, one of the things that we are all now tied up in is circuits. And these are circuits of transmission of information, if you will. I'm not so certain myself what information is. I prefer to think of them as circuits of reference, and through those references, we create networks and knowledge representations, but they're also circuits of power. And I'll come back to that in a minute. And I don't mean that, again, in the trivial sense of the electricity running through the worldwide grid, but as any of us who've ever lived on the edge of that electrical grid know, it's a very real material circumstance. When you get your power 8 hours at a time on a schedule that's published in the newspaper, you get 8 hours every 24 hours, you become very aware of something, again, that we're taking for granted in the background here. So, George, who may or may not be here now, said something that resonated again about structure being present independently of content. And in fact, content came up as an issue. And we're all, I think, wary of the rhetoric of the commercialization of us as content providers for this insatiable machine. And if we are, in fact, instead creators of structure rather than content, or, as Sharon said, context providers, creators of context, then I think we are occupying a space that's actually a much more productive space with respect to the potentials to use any technology to connect people together, which is what one of the meanings of interface emphasizes and what the splice makes impossible to ignore. Finally, a few connections that were sparked by Jeff Bowker's talk this afternoon, and actually I have to read one line which I've written down very carefully here, so let me find this. Am I going to be able to find it? You know, one of the tragedies of getting older is that I can't actually see my own notes. I need to do this, and I can't do that. So, well, metaphors be with you. I don't know if I'm crediting that slide to the wrong person. I apologize. I may be the only person who sat there and read it and realized it was may the force be with you. Metaphors be with you. Yes? It's a wonderful slide because what it illustrates is the fact that these kinds of splices we're dealing with are splices that can radically disjoin the visual from the vocal, the auditory from the representational. So metaphors be with you. The universal timelines always splinter. And indeed, I think we can look at Evil Bert as a splinter in time. And a splinter in perception. And here I'd want to underline that it's not that people didn't see Bert in that poster. They saw something, but they had no circulating reference to Bertify, if you will, those blobs and colors. And so the question that would have been interesting for the New York Times to pursue was, what did people see? Not did they see Bert. And that's actually, for me, the nub of the international hegemony of knowledge that we're living under. The question no one thought to ask, no one considered important, is, what did you see there? What is this thing before we ask, do you see Bert? And, of course, once the question, do you see Bert, is asked, Bert is all you can see. And I think that's the essential character of a useful materializing metaphor. Once you see Bert, that's all you can see, so you revise the poster. And not intentional, sorry, moving on to Mark Poster from Posters. Mark Poster said, I'm sorry, it wasn't intentional, but it's right here. What we are in a condition of being able to do is noiseless and incoherent transmission. And this is, again, one of the reasons to be wary of this word information. We're transmitting things. And that's why I come back to the materiality. We're transmitting real things. But the things aren't necessarily carrying along with them any kind of meaningful information, of any kind of signal in that, I think, rather old-fashioned model of what it is we do, what it is I'm doing right now. So, given all of the kinds of things that we sort of cumulatively, corporately have had to say, I'm led to one last query. Why is it that the word universality has actually come up at several points? Several speakers have, in fact, characterized this as a universal structure. This World Wide Web, electronic mediation, digital universe, as something that is a universal and may in fact have universal qualities. I'm a professional skeptic about this as an anthropologist. I have to be a professional skeptic about universality in the way that seems to haunt us here. Universality, I would suggest, seems to come with the deterritorialization that this instantaneous transmission provides us with. The despatialization that this web provides us with. And so I think it's not insignificant that many of the metaphors that we've seen over the last 2 days take space and proximity and connections and hops and movement and the theater as the place to begin to recuperate some of the sense that this is not universal in that sense of coherent everywhere, even if it's universal in some other sense of a set of conditions that are universally different and differentially universal. And I end with the map, though, a warning, the map is not the terrain. The question that came from over in that corner about maps and the viewpoint of maps, I think is inadequately responded to if the response is that our resolution of the map will get better and better. If the viewpoint of the map is the viewpoint from above, making it a better and better resolution is not the solution. What the map instead has to be juxtaposed to is the viewscape or the viewshed used not as a tool to fool people into not seeing what's around them, but as a sense of the differential ways that differently situated persons see the space. And if I were to invent my own metaphor for this, that might be where I would want to end, is can we imagine a spatialized, localized, on the ground, face-to-face, that is human-scaled experience that is not simultaneously reduced to the human looking through the window? I'm going to end there, and I'm going to open this up to general discussion. And again, anything over the last 2 days is fair game. I'm going to ask two things, though. One is that you either project, and I know Lev will project, or if you're way over there, please stand up, because it's very difficult to hear the questions otherwise. And if I think I can't hear it, I will ask you to repeat.